Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second episode of A New Philosophy.
Hi, this is Future Me editing the video. I am so sorry that we're only 4 seconds in and I'm already making a mistake, but this is actually episode one. This is the first episode. I am so sorry. There were some production delays on my part, so I had to move the schedule around. So I'm posting this one first, and then what was episode one is going to become episode two. So I am so sorry about that if it's confusing, but every time I say episode two, I actually mean episode one. So anyways, back to it.
So today we're going to be talking about the inauguration and everything that comes with it. You know, this is kind of a weird moment in history. We've been here before and now we're somehow back, and we're going to talk about what do we do? We might talk a little bit about how we got here, but I think what's on everybody's mind right now is just like, what do we do? Where do we go forward from here? And I'm joined by my esteemed guest here. I will let you reintroduce yourself.
Yeah, I guess I should introduce myself for the video portion. So hi, everyone. My name is Yasmin. Oh my God, what do I even say about myself? I'm a small, obviously Puerto Rican girl from New Jersey. I have done many professions, but I've been an organizer for about 10 years now. And currently I work full-time in the political sphere for a political organization that puts forth different progressive campaigns, mainly in human resources, with the focus on professional development, DEI, and just other kind of strategic planning. Outside of that, I do a lot of community-based building in my own community for kind of more hyper-localized campaigns, including, different ways that old buildings are going to be utilized, and community gardening and other things of that nature. So it's a little bit of a background about me. Yeah.
And a little bit of a sneak peek as to what we're going to be talking about today. Yeah. So, I think let's just start with the election results. It happened.
Yeah.
And I think that for a time, because this is going to come out at a later point in time, but we're kind of coming pretty fresh off of it. It's only been a couple of weeks since the election, and we've already seen rhetoric going around about people blaming certain groups of people, either non-voters or one-issue voters. But what's your read on all of this finger-pointing, basically?
My read on it is the oligarchs are very much definitely happy that the finger pointing is happening. I've seen a lot of different takes on social media and the sorts, and after a lot of the polls and the numbers came out, it turned out that, third party voters and those that didn't vote at all wouldn't have helped Harris's campaign as much as people wanted to have believed. I actually had gotten into kind of this little not an argument, but discussion with somebody that I used to be friends with many years ago, because I posted something unrelated about the Puerto Rican elections, because that was happening at the same time on the same day. And if you didn't know, Puerto Ricans don't have representation in the United States elections, or really we don't have representation in the elections, and we also don't really have representation when it comes to Congress or other parts of the decision makers that do make decisions on the island itself. So in Puerto Rico, they actually had like an honorary election for the presidents. People had like this printed piece of paper where they could vote for either like Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. And a lot of people just put like Free Palestine, because obviously being from an indigenous land, a lot of people have feelings of what it means to be using the bombs that were tested on our land in another place that's creating destruction and havoc. But I posted that and gotten into a discussion with somebody that, was arguing with me about why third party voting was wrong. And it was very stark to me a little bit, or maybe not stark isn't the right word. It was very jarring, because the commentary that I made had nothing to do with the election that was going on in the United States. It it had to do with like things that impacted me at a different level and that impact people like me and people from my island. But even in that conversation, you know, it's like, well, people have their reasonings for wanting to vote third party. Mm-hmm. People have their reasonings for not wanting to vote at all. And some people, you know, if you look at some of the polls, even though they voted blue in the last election, voted for Trump during this election. And there's a reason for that, too. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you know, if we really, for the people that do not support Trump, because I don't think that third party voters support Trump. I don't think that a lot of the people that didn't vote support Trump or like have that kind of overt support for him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, instead of kind of butting our heads to like against each other and pitting these different arguments, we really should be thinking about how to really truly build that sort of solidarity that will be needed to oppose what's to come, right? And we can only speculate off of the things that we've seen either on Twitter or on you know, when I say Twitter, I'm talking about Twitter by like Elon Musk and other more prominent people that have these positions of power. But, you know, it can be speculation up to a point. But when we draw back to things that we know of things that happened during his last presidency, you know, there's real fear to be had there. And we shouldn't let the fear paralyze us. We should let it drive us. And so that's kind of my first initial thoughts and my first initial takes on all these things. You know, I'm sure we'll talk more about how to actually put those things into action.
Yeah.
But yeah, my take is, you know, we shouldn't really be pointing fingers too much at each other. We have all a reason to be either angry or upset, but we shouldn't allow those feelings to get in the way of the fight that we still need to continue having.
Yeah, well, and something that you mentioned that sort of stood out to me there was kind of talking about how you were sort of approaching talking about this election, like you were talking specifically about that mock election and people sort of like coming at you because they're like, well, wait a second, what do you mean? Like, are you supporting third parties? And like, that's not going to help us. But I think that sometimes we forget that our country is huge. Every state elects the president a different way. Every state has different voting laws. Every state has different, even different say. And like, you know, with the Electoral College, some states have more power than others to sort of influence the election. So it's not good for us to sort of like blanket say like anyone across the country, like you're a bad person for voting third party or you're a bad person for doing this. You're like letting them win because it's not always the case. You know, if we're talking about someone in New York who's voting third party or even not voting at all, they're probably not going to have much sway as somebody who lives in a swing state that has like maybe less electors where they know that it's going to go for like one or the other. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think that was, I mean, that definitely came up in the conversation that I had with this person. What I will say, I mean, how I was approached, and what was said, it was a lot of assumptions, mm-hmm. right? So, and I see that happen a lot too. Like instead of wanting to understand and ask questions to understand like, well, okay, why? Or like, what is your take on this? Because I don't think I really said anything in this post. I think I just reposted a picture and I didn't add any of my own commentary. And so it's kind of, you know, I think about that, like it's bad campaigning. It's bad organizing. It's bad anything. If you're for a movement or you're for, you know, a specific candidate or different things like that, you really need to be understanding your base in order to inoculate your base, right? And mm-hmm. those are organizing terms, but like you really need to understand your audience, right? And mm-hmm. where they lie, whether they're your supporters or they're not your supporters. But you know, in order to get to the bottom or to get them kind of on the same page as you, you need to be having conversations that are not based on assumptions, mm-hmm. that are not based on you know, like personal attacks or calling each other names or just kind of just saying things without actually doing the research, right? Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the conversation that I had with this person and things that did come up, right? I live in New York, and you know, it's a majority blue state. And regardless if I would have voted third party or not, even though this person assumed that I was voting for Jill Stein, which I never even made a post about her ever in my life. But they made that assumption. And the conversation I had with them, well, one, I never said that. I don't know why you would have assumed that. And then two, even if I would have, like, statistically in my state and the way electoral politics work, this is what the majority outcome would be. And if I'm wrong, then happy to debrief with you and have a conversation about it. But, like, third-party voters are not going to make up a significant amount to have swayed the results in this state any which one way. And it turned out that I was correct, right? It turned out that the third-party voters made up, I think, 3%, and those that didn't vote weren't going to be enough to, at least in other states, let Kamala win or give her, like, the electoral vote. So yeah.
Yeah, and if we were to sort of talk about any group of people when it comes to voting, I think that, like, from my very naive read of this, having seen, like, the exit poll statistics and everything, what we can generally say is that the biggest group of people that is unreached are those undecided voters who just casually follow politics and they think of voting as being, like, a chore and just sort of are those, like, well, what's in it for me types of people. And what we saw, like, from the 2020 election up until now is that the numbers for both parties are down. So in that sense, it's almost like that group of people, again, this is like the naive read on it, but it's almost like that group of people who are undecided is growing larger. And with Kamala's campaign, she tried really hard to reach those people, or sort of like reach the people she thought the Republicans were going to win over. And it turns out the Republicans actually gained a lot in many jurisdictions and got that middle undecided group of voters. So to sort of set the tone for what exactly the campaigns did during this election, we saw a lot about how people just ignored the working class. And this happens time and time again. There was... My dog would like to move.
Okay. You're good.
You want to come up here? Yeah? Okay. Come on. Good girl. So, you know, we saw... Where was I going with that? We saw that, like, both parties were down. Republicans did actually gain, and that does not contradict itself. Those two statements can be said together in the same sentence. But what we see is that Trump is getting those people that the Democrats are forgetting about. And the people that they're forgetting about are not bigots. They're not, like, super, super conservative. They're just mostly not uneducated, but they're not, like, quite as tuned into politics. So really all they're caring about is their basic needs, and that's all they should care about, really. And the Democrats are missing that. Like, what can Democrats do? And not Democrat voters, we're talking about, like, capital D Democrats, like politician Democrats. What can they do to actually talk to those people that the Republicans won over?
That's a very that's a good question.
It's a little loaded, too.
It's a little loaded. As someone who is very anti-establishment, want to give the Democrats the strategies to win over people? maybe not. But no, wow, that's a really good one. I mean, some of the things I think about when you're saying these things along the lines, I mean, it's just, I mean, it goes back to, like, bad campaigning and bad organizing to a certain extent. But on the other extent, you know, there was a lot of, oh, my God. I'm sorry. That was so cute. I got distracted. But, yeah, I was saying, yeah, that is a little bit of a loaded question for someone who is very much anti the system in some ways. But, you know, I think about that. I mean, I think of a couple things, right? First, going back to, like, bad campaigning and bad organizing is one thing I think about. But I think about a lot of, like, the rhetoric for, like, this election, right, and this campaign over the last however many months, year, whatever. Well, I guess a couple months, because Harris only got into the race not too long ago over the summer. But, you know, there was a lot of rhetoric of her trying to appeal to those more moderate, conservative voters, mm-hmm. right? Like, she was trying to appeal to, I guess, those kind of in the middle that are not, like, hard R, capital R, Republican, but yeah. It wasn't effective, mm-hmm. right? You know, she was supposed to be good for the environment, but then, you know, said how much she would support fracking. Mm-hmm. And that just, like, didn't even really make sense. So for people that I at least understand, right, like, what it means to protect the environment, what environmental protections look like, and how bad fracking is for the environment, it's just, like, you're saying two contradictory statements. So even for someone that does understand and does know politics and does know, like, I guess a little bit more than just, like, meeting their basic needs, like, you're not reaching them. You're not going to reach them no matter how many feminine nomina TikToks you put out there.
It's just not brat enough.
Yeah, just so brat to be in a huge supporter of fracking. Really interesting, that one. But on the other hand, like, you're right. There's, I mean, when it comes down to even just organizing in general, one of the main things, or not one of the main, well, yeah, main things, but one of the things that are definitely up there, right, is a level of political education. Mm-hmm. You can't just be saying, we need to change something, we need to change something, we need to change something. You need to understand what it is that you need to change and why. And then from there, you need to understand what's the disconnect. Why aren't people motivated enough towards this one thing? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it seems like, based off of some of the polls, which the polls are, you know, it's not the entirety of the U.S. And then also it depends on, like, who answers and versus people who don't. Right. So the data there is not 100% accurate. It's right. definitely skewed. It's definitely biased to whoever actually had that reach. But a lot of people voted because of the economy. Mm-hmm. The economy, we've all been saying it, inflation has gotten so bad. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why there should have been a period of time where eggs were like almost fucking $7 by my house, right? Mm-hmm. And in some places they still are pretty that high. But you know, people need to understand what that means. Do I think Trump is going to be good for the economy? Hell fucking no. Mm-hmm. But do people understand why? Do they understand why? Some people probably do. A lot of people probably don't. But it's, like, it goes into that political education. Like, in order to be able to bridge that disconnect, you need to, like, be able to educate people. You need to be able to speak to their needs and their desires or just things that they, I mean, just basic needs, right? And I don't think we've seen enough to bridge that divide. We saw a lot of memes. We saw a lot of TikToks. We saw a lot of, he's a felon and I'm top cop. Which, yeah, it was funny. I hee-heed a little bit, but at the end of the day, you know, this is not fun and games. Mm-hmm. This is our livelihoods.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's kind of ironic too, because when it comes to politics, politicians and like political strategists will always say that like, you have to sell a simple message to people. And in some respects, I think that the Harris campaign did actually sell a simple message. It just was the wrong message to the wrong people. Because they did give that, you know, you had mentioned the whole, like, Trump's a felon and I'm the top cop. And that message is just not going to resonate with Trump supporters because they don't care. They just straight up don't care that he's a felon. They don't care what he did. They don't care that he should be in jail. Like, they just don't care about that. So that simple narrative might be effective for, like, your base, but it's not going to be effective on them who you're claiming to try to bring over. And then another thing that I've seen in sort of the general discourse is that Democrats only want to talk about identity politics. And, you know, if you look at the two campaigns side by side, when we think about, like, the quote-unquote identity politics, most people think, like, LGBTQIA+, racial justice, things like that. Mm-hmm. But the Harris campaign certainly talked about those issues, and some could even argue didn't do enough to talk about those things or talk about them in the right way, right, as I'm sure you understand. But this was not an election that was lost because of identity politics. Like, let's be very clear. You want to talk about identity politics. That was all Trump's campaign. That was all identity politics. Yeah. Like, he's a showman. He's basically a showman. Perfect politician, if you're like, I hate to say it, but, you know, he does fit that bill quite well. So it's not a shock to me that he got elected. But I guess moving on to what his actual plans for office are, because you had kind of brought up, you know, there's a disconnect between what his policies are and what they can actually affect. And I think, like, one of the biggest things that I actually didn't write here in the agenda, but, like, his plans for the economy are just silly. They're silly. And they're, again, this is an easy message to sell to people because China's the bad guy, right? Like, oh my God, China's taking all of our jobs. They're taking all of our manufacturing. So how do we fix that? Well, we penalize them by imposing all these tariffs. And it's like, yeah. Well, who pays those tariffs though?
Right.
American companies.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a whole discourse. And I think I even had seen, also on social media that somebody, like, once the results came out, somebody worked in a company that had to sit them down and talk about, like, all the increased costs they were going to have.
Yeah.
And talk about possible layoffs because the increased cost was going to have negative effects on the business.
Exactly.
So, I mean, those are some of the things that, you know, there's a disconnect there. I think, I mean, we've seen even some videos of the rallies where people are like, yeah, tariffs, and they just don't really understand how they work. And then also, on the other hand, just like his tax plans have always been kind of atrocious. I mean, I know a lot of people felt the after effect of some of the things he was able to pass while he was in office. Mm-hmm. And his plans for this round around, I believe I did some digging. I try not to overwhelm myself with too much information at one time because it's very overwhelming.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. But yeah, he's looking to reduce taxes for people over a certain tax bracket that the majority of us are just not in. Uh-huh. Yeah. So yeah, those are some of the things in terms of like the economics, but
yeah. Well, and coincidentally, I actually did the numbers on this because it was either the Congressional Budget Office or one of those like NGOs that does all of the calculations for all of these bills. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which I believe was passed in 2017, but it was set to expire next year because that's when he's going to be back in office, or at that point, if Biden were to be reelected or whatever, it was going to expire so that, you know, everybody could blame the Democrats. But the average person, like everyday person, got about $40 a month back on tax savings. So you tell me, is that enough to, like, make a substantial difference?
$40 enough? No. Like, I can't even pay my internet bill with that.
Right.
And I work from home, and I need my internet.
Right.
Yeah.
No. And he wants to extend that. So he said that he was just going to extend the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or if he changes it in any way, at the time of recording, I haven't seen any substantial changes to his plan. So I'm going to just assume that he's going to carry over what he passed in 2017. But if that is to continue, we can at least confidently say that people's lives are not going to be made better by that. It's certainly not going to tackle inflation, which is also not really necessarily a thing that the president controls directly anyways, but it certainly wouldn't help. And any quote-unquote savings that we would have in our taxes are probably going to be offset by the inflation that's going to be caused by his various trade policies, which
yeah.
Every economist worth their snuff has been saying that this is bad. It's an inflationary policy.
Right.
Don't do it.
I mean, I think it's also important to note that, like, when a lot of us are throwing around this buzzword of inflation, but, like, realistically, a lot of the prices that we see in grocery stores or for, like, goods and services are inflated, like, on purpose, mm-hmm. Which is not directly tied to the economic concept of inflation, but tied to just the concept of, you know, companies just maintaining high prices, even though mm-hmm. their cost of like shipments and different things like that were higher during COVID went back down, right? Mm-hmm. So like we saw this big increased during COVID, and that, you know, was inflated because of what was going on in the world and different supply chain issues. But now that those things have been resolved, the prices have not. Mm-hmm. And so we throw around the buzzword inflation, but there's a lot of things going on when it comes to like why everything is so expensive now, right? Like Jeff Bezos, there's a few others. I know like Jeff Bezos is the owner of Amazon, but a few other like grocery store chains or other companies have seen record profits after COVID. They've tripled some of their wealth, which is like unheard of. And you know, money just, even though we print it, it doesn't just create itself, right? It's mm-hmm. it's supposed to be tied to something. It's supposed to be tied to like a precious metal, to be able to have value. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, and kind of tangentially related to the economy is immigration, because that's something that he's been touting for a long time now. Even well before his campaign, he was like, we need to deport all these, and I'm only repeating it just because it's what he said, but all these illegal immigrants and stuff like that. So on the topic of immigration, like, we shouldn't be downplaying the reality of the fact that if he has enough support, which he does, and now we have a Republican-controlled Congress and most of the state legislating bodies as well are now leaning Republican. So, like, how should we be thinking about his plan to deport, I think he said 25 million immigrants, which is, to be clear, those estimates are way too high. Like, it's only estimated that there's upwards of like 10 million at the most.
Yeah.
Quote unquote illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants is the right term to be using here, but there's at most 10 million undocumented immigrants. So when he throws around this 25 million number, his followers are expecting there to be 25 million people that are going to be deported. And I think that you and I know from history, that's not going to be just undocumented immigrants. It's going to be anybody that he deems not worthy of staying in this country, which is also going to include people who are outwardly, like, outspoken leftists, outspoken organizers, political dissidents. So should we be scared? Like, how should we be thinking about this?
Should we be scared? Yeah, that's the eternal question. We should be scared.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say it. We should be scared. I want to go back. Like, we shouldn't let fear control us in a way where we don't do anything about it and we just like hide in our little caves, but we should be worried. I mean, on one end, right? I mean, I used to work at a labor center for undocumented workers, and they pay taxes. There is this huge misconception that undocumented workers do not pay taxes, but unless they are getting paid strictly cash, which is not really a thing any longer in this economy, they pay taxes, and their tax bracket is 40%. They pay 40% of their earnings to taxes, which is almost half, right? So that's one thing to think about, that like we will lose some of those taxpaying, not citizens, but taxpaying workers. And then on the other hand, they've already been talking about, you know, trying to do something like an unnaturalization process, which is not just going to affect immigrants of what they deem to be the global south, unless they have established like loopholes, which they always do, right? It's not uncommon for those to happen. But in general, you know, the rhetoric that they've been using in order to get away with like why to justify deportation of these undocumented immigrants, sorry, my brain is like short circuiting now, to justify deporting these undocumented immigrants is, well, one, they paint them to be criminals, thugs, et cetera, et cetera. They steal our jobs, right? Or they either steal our jobs or they're not productive members of society. It can go either way. And that kind of rhetoric can be applied to many different groups, mm-hmm. right? And so one day we'll be targeting undocumented immigrants. Another day we could be targeting anyone who speaks up in opposition to whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you are of a marginalized background, that percentage or that chance of that happening becomes ever so much more likely. It goes back to, we were reading this past week, but one of the things I read over the past week when it came to trying to fight against or like dismantling tyranny was the idea of the way that they get rid of the opposition is by slicing them out one by one. So we should be worried, even if it's a group that doesn't directly affect us or it's not personally my problem, because one day it's them, the next day it's you, the next day it's that person over there, and then the next day it could be me. Mm-hmm. Especially when it comes to, just overall thematically what's going on based off of history, right? We're seeing an increase in what a lot of historians would call fascism. And those have like real historical implications, right? Mm-hmm. I'll stop there.
No, it's okay. I think that too, kind of going along with that is thinking about other communities that his administration will target. There's also the LGBTQIA+ community as well. We've already seen that his Supreme Court nominees or his Supreme Court choices that are currently still on the Supreme Court are no friend to the LGBT community. And they are no friend to women. They are no friend to immigrants. So this is also a group of people that is going to need protection. And a lot of people are going to point to what Trump said in 2016 when he got elected. In 2016, during his inauguration ceremony, he did explicitly say, "I vow to protect the LGBT community." Maybe not in those like exact words, but he did say, "I will protect gay people," basically. And come to find out, like, that didn't really come to fruition. Like, he installed one openly gay person to his cabinet who then, like, went on to do some campaigns to advocate for gay rights in other countries. It's funny how we can sit here and, like, do all of this stuff in other countries, but then when it comes to our own country, it's like, well, I don't know. Guess we're just gonna have to deal with the bigotry or something. Like, I don't know. We have our noses in so many other people's business that we don't care to look at ourselves. And I think where I was going with that is just that how are we going to protect our queer brothers and sisters? And like, how are we going to be able to, like, where is the overlap between them and other communities?
Other communities in terms of what exactly?
Any minority community. Because this, when we talk about, like, solidarity and intersectionality, this is a very, like, one type of oppression begets, like, other types of oppression as well.
Yeah.
There's this idea that, like, if we were to simply help gay people, like, that doesn't necessarily help women in a sense, but if you get to the root underlying bigotry, it almost like helps everybody. It helps women, it helps queer people, black people, people of color, etc.
I hear what you're saying. I think one, it's important to look at identity through an intersectional lens, right? Because yes, support queer people, but if we talk about like what does that mean for other marginalized communities, there are queer people that are also people of color, mm-hmm. and they have to face both of those kind of intersections of the discrimination and challenges that they're faced with in society.
Yeah.
Similarly to like, women, yes, right? Like Trump and his supporters are very much trying, or did they say, what was it? Did they say that they wanted to have like a national ban on abortion? And we're seeing how that is playing out in states that they've already kind of put those limitations and the lives that are that have been cost, right, through these things. But, you know, I see, and I think this goes back to, like, why there is some disconnect and why some people are pointing fingers and why some people just, like, don't really feel moved to do much. When you think about this, like, healthcare for women, and in that sense, when it comes to an abortion ban, I mean, overall, if people already had cared about healthcare for women, especially black women are 3 times more likely to die during labor and always have been, right? I think just last month or a couple months ago, I want to say in Brooklyn, a woman died during labor after, like, complaining about different pain and other complications, and she was ignored. Mm. And in general, there's a there's a theme there, not only just with black women, but, you know, different marginalized identities going to the hospital and complaining of some sort of pain or complication and not being taken seriously, which also happens. And it goes back to racism, right? Mm-hmm. Like, doctors used to learn that black people had higher pain tolerances, and some of them still fucking do. And that's an issue, right? These are all issues, and they always have been issues. So when I think about what you said, right, and how, like, we protect these different communities, I mean, it goes back to, one, learning about the intersectionalities of our identity and what that means, right? Mm-hmm. And not just in a more whitewashed way of, like, I love everyone, in the same way that some people are colorblind, right? We can't be colorblind. We can't be, we can't just, like, kind of passively just accept, like, yes, I love everything and everyone without really caring about the communities, really caring about different people that are affected for different reasons.
So let's change gears a little bit and get into some more practical things that people can do. Because I think that a lot of people are just looking for something and somewhere to give their energy. I know that a lot of people are going to be very reflexively choosing places to donate to. They're going to be wanting to spend their time somewhere. So let's talk a little bit about how people should be thinking about, what does it mean to actually, like, form community? And I think that that's actually a good, like, first question is, like, in your mind, what is community exactly?
What is community? I mean, community is community. I don't know. How do you define it? I think when I think of community, I think of, like, my neighbors. When I think of community, I think of, like, my family, my friends, and the people that I can trust and confide in. When I think of community, I think of, like, the infrastructures that are already in place around me, where people kind of generally commune, right? The library, community gardens, other third spaces, even though there's a lack of third spaces, but, like, other places where I can genuinely just be accepted, be myself, be passionate about the things I want to see, that are free and not always, right, but free of mind-altering substances, right? Mm-hmm. Like, having a safe space to just be without needing those things. And not that I'm super straight edge and I'm like, no smoking, no drinking. But sometimes I like to just have my mind clear, and I like to not be able to depend on having to smoke to free my anxiety, or to drink to, like, free my anxiety of, like, how I'm perceived.
Yeah. Heard. No, it's funny because I think that when I lived in New York for a little bit, you know this, but I always tell people that New York, compared to where I live now, is, like, way more. Isn't there, like, close to 10 million people that live in New York? The population? It's I'll high. Have to it's I'll there. Have to fact check it. A lot of people live in New York. Mm. And ironically, when I lived in New York is when I felt the most lonely. Which to me was, like, kind of weird because I was constantly surrounded by people. And this was kind of, like, towards the tail end of the pandemic, even though the pandemic never really ended. You know, this was kind of at the tail end of the pandemic, and people were starting to go back outside. There was lots of people everywhere, constantly having events. But I still felt very lonely. And I lived in a building that had about, like, 900 units in it. So you'd think that I'd be brushing up against people all the time. But the thing that I found is that it was really hard to just, like, casually meet people. It was really hard to actually form good community. And kind of, like, where I was going with that is that to form community, you have to be very intentional, because you can't just sort of like expect these groups to just crop up out of nowhere. Like, usually when we think about mutual aid groups, which we're going to talk about later, these groups arise out of some sort of need that mm-hmm. has to be met, right?
Yeah.
And when we think about community, I think that community can only truly thrive if it's actually like serving the needs of the people that make up that community. So This isn't a simple like, oh, we need to like create these groups for people to join. We need to be very intentional about why we're creating it. What exactly is it that this group is going to do? How can we actually achieve those aims? So one of the things that I had on here to talk about actually was mutual aid. And I know you have a little bit of experience. You know, you had mentioned organizing experience. I think you also have worked in some capacity in mutual aid organizations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about what that was like for you.
Yeah. I mean, well, I want to say first things first, yeah, I agree with not creating something new. I think a lot of times people want to reinvent the wheel, and we have to do something because no one's doing something. But to say that and to believe that is really disingenuous, unless you're really, like a really insular community where really is like just a few people and not people are really not doing much. But people are out there. People are doing stuff, and people are active in their own way. But in terms of my experience with mutual aid, so mutual aid, you know, is separate from charity, right? Mm-hmm. It's separate from just donating and doing something for a good cause. And when I was in college, actually, we had a lot of different volunteer organizations. And although maybe at the time I thought and told myself I'm doing mutual aid, but mutual aid needs to be mutual. There needs to be a mutually benefiting relationship in that sense, where, you know, it's a give and take, and people are learning from each other about why it is important to do in the first place. So I guess when I worked at the labor center was, it was my full-time job at the time, but that was kind of the most hands-on experience I had with mutual aid, because I was there, you know, 9 to 5, 40 hours a week. But what it was, you know, doing outreach, going out and talking to people. That was our target audience. And at there, obviously, it was undocumented workers in the city that had no protections and oftentimes were vulnerable to be victims of crimes. So we would go out and look for these corners that they would stand in order to talk to them about their rights in the city and their protections that they have and legal resources and recourse in case of anything were to happen. What else did we do? I mean, part of it was also like we had to meet a need. We had to meet them where they were at, right? We were with a lot of people that just didn't have any money. They were poor. A lot of them were homeless. And a lot of times they didn't even have food. So in order to kind of meet them where they were at and at least get sort of, you know, the receptiveness for them to listen to us and what we had to say was to be inviting and welcoming. Like we had an office where they could always come and we'd make sure to let them know. But when we would go out, we would see new people all the time. We would go out with coffee, with pastries. Sometimes we would go out with groceries. One time we did an entire toy drive because a lot of these women had children and had no family, no friends, no community to really be able to tap into. And so, yeah, I think part of mutual aid in a way is building that community in a sense, right? Like you have to know what you're aiming and working towards. And for us was just making sure that, you know, women knew their rights when they were out in the labor force, even though they were undocumented, and then helping them getting set up with services that can help them really, I don't want to say the word integrate, but set up to like be, I guess, I don't even know the right word. I don't want to say functioning member of society either, but set them up to just be able to have their basic needs met and things that they were deserving of because they did pay, like I said, a 40% tax rate. So if they were making $10 an hour, they would see six of those dollars. And then that is, you know, for 40 hours, it's not even enough to buy. I mean, especially in this economy now, to mm-hmm. even buy groceries. So yeah, that's my experience with mutual aid. Did you have like a question? Did you want to know any more about that, or?
Well, you brought up that mutual aid is not charity, and I think that Americans particularly are so conditioned to charity for a lot of different reasons. And I think when we talk about the concept of charity just kind of in abstract, a lot of this dates back to like Christian morals, right? And part of that is that charity is really looking at a fixed finite pool of resources and saying, who are the best people to get those resources? And mutual aid takes quite a big departure from that by saying we should not be like recreating the same hierarchies that exist outside of the charity space within our charity, which is what ends up happening. Because talk about like homeless people, you had brought up, or unhoused people, you had brought up that a lot of the intersectionality there is that maybe they're dealing with mental health issues, they might be dealing with substance abuse issues, they might be dealing with childcare issues. All of these things combined might be contributing to the reason why they currently are unhoused. So traditional charity structures would look at that and say, okay, well, we can give you housing, but you're going to have to stop doing drugs. You're going to have to get a job. You're going to have to do all of these things. How is mutual aid different from the way that we usually think about charity? And why is that better?
So, yeah, we already kind of said, but, you know, mutual aid is mutual, where charity, as you already mentioned, has those different hierarchies that do strip away people of their autonomy, right? So you have, like, a decision maker, and then you have the people that are subject to those decisions. And while, yes, some people may need a little bit more support and may not be fully capable of making certain decisions, in some instances, a lot of the times, that is really not the case. And, you know, people are adults and should be able to have dignity in their lives. And then going back a little bit, I didn't mention it, but, you know, when I was working at the labor center, while, like, yes, to some extent, as an employee, as someone that's documented, and as someone that also even speaks the language in this country, there's a level of power that I have there, and that, you know, that you just have, and you just have to be really cautious and conscious of how that power is implemented, in order to not strip people of their autonomy and their power. And the way that we did that, you know, eventually, I mean, that labor center had been there for years. I want to say some of the members, you know, the women at the labor center that became members, were members for 3 or 4 plus years at this labor center, and eventually became our, like, leaders of the labor center. So instead of me talking as someone who was never a day laborer in New York City as a migrant, we would have other women that had that experience as a day laborer, and how they were able to grow professionally to making now, you know, way more than minimum wage in the city. And also they had decision-making power to a certain extent, or like input on what kind of training programs and other like workforce development programs they wanted to see, what were the things that they really needed. And so in that way, it's mutual, right? Like, we're giving something, but we're also receiving that feedback to know how best to pour back into the community. And that's just one example of a structure, right? At like a more, I guess, formalized workplace, but that can be replicated in a lot of different other communities, right? Like, a community garden would probably model the same thing, in which you're asking people in the community, what are the things you want to plant? How do we plant this? And you get people involved in actually doing the work, and it benefits everyone. It doesn't just benefit the person that started it or owns it or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that when you talk about those sort of feedback loops, that's something that traditional charities are missing a lot, because it's in a lot of ways just one way, you know, like they've got some sort of good or service that they're trying to provide, but they just sort of administer it. And I think that's a lot of the reason why we see charities come out with so much administrative bloat. Like, isn't the average that only 80 to 90% of the actual, like, funds that you donate go towards doing stuff? There's still that, like, 10 plus percent of administrative bloat, bureaucracy. Have you worked for a nonprofit before?
The Labor Center was a nonprofit.
Oh, it was a nonprofit. Okay, so you're probably well aware of the bureaucracy that comes with it.
I definitely have my critiques. I left for a reason, although obviously it wasn't the workers that were the reason. But
sure.
But yeah, I mean, it also, I mean, in traditional charity, it also keeps people dependent, right? There's no solution.
Yeah.
It's not, it's like we're giving and meeting a need, but people will always have perpetual needs if the issue itself is not really resolved, right?
Yes.
And so in some cases, right, let's say like food. Yes, we can give out food and we can meet that immediate need, but unless we create an infrastructure where there people have this need met, or they're being set up with SNAP benefits, for example, and things like that, that's where like the disconnect is. So it definitely is not a system that aims to put an end to whatever their goal is of like the need that they're aiming to meet or whatever it is.
Right. Well, and that reminds me too of what you were saying earlier about autonomy and the fact that these people, even though they're in a time of need, like they know how to best meet their needs. They probably just don't have those resources. And it made me think of the fact that we almost sort of bake that helplessness into the whole idea of needing charity to begin with, right? We think of poor people as being less than in a way, like they don't have the ability to take care of themselves, and that's why they're in this precarious situation.
Yeah.
And because that's so ingrained into our collective cultural understanding of poverty and just of being in need in general, because I think that like charity can come into play not necessarily for people that are impoverished as well.
It goes back to like, I mean, in the same framework, right? You know, a lot of people when they don't like want to give something to a homeless person, they'll be like, well, I'll buy you food, but I won't give you money. And it's like,
what are they gonna do with that
money?
What
are they gonna do with the money? Yeah. Whatever the fuck they want, they're not gonna be able to buy an apartment with the money, so like they're not gonna be unhoused anymore, or like now, you know, they're not gonna be like housed now because you gave them like $5.
Yeah.
So if they want to fucking buy a cigarette, let them buy a cigarette. I mean, I'd probably want to be smoking I don't even smoke cigarettes, but I'd probably want to smoke a cigarette if I had to live out in frigid temperatures.
So we've talked a lot about what mutual aid is and sort of like why it's necessary and how that's going to help us going forward. But I think a lot of people are also concerned about joining the right place, right? And I think my read on that is kind of like, join anything. Like you were saying earlier, don't start your own thing, because somebody out there is probably already doing what you want to do. You just need to find that group and go do it and help them because they need your help. But what sort of things do you look for whenever you're joining an organization? Like, how do you think about whether or not you're a right fit? And is there anything that you've learned along the way that you could maybe share with others?
Honestly, how I've done it traditionally versus how I do it now, maybe, or how I did it when I was younger versus how I do it now. I would say, do a lot of introspection first is where I would start, or where I do start, right? My one big piece of advice is going to be, you know, community care is important, but so is self-care. It's really, really very common to have burnout. Burnout because, you know, you get involved, you're passionate about some of these issues, but sometimes it feels like these issues will never resolve because of all the things that happen on a day-to-day basis. So start small is what I would have done had I've been telling myself this maybe 10 years ago when I was in college, but start small and pick something that you're passionate about and that's doable, right? Things are not going to change overnight. You're not going to solve world hunger or any of these like bigger kind of systematic issues in a day, in a month, in a year. But start with things that are local to you, are things that you can control. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, a lot of times I feel like when I talk to people about things that they want to do and things that they're passionate about, a lot of times people want to be either like the poster child, or they want to be like the face of whatever said movement is. And I would steer away from any type of thinking along those lines, because one, we shouldn't be doing things because we want to get recognition for them. We should be doing things because it's for the good of all of us. So don't try to start your own thing. Don't try to be the face of whatever it is. Even I'm super uncomfortable on camera, which is why I'm like barely looking into it. But, you know, do things that are tangible. Do things that you can. And even if it feels like you're not doing much, I mean, like now, because I work full-time, kind of like I said, I support campaigns and different things like that, and that can be really exhausting. But at the end of the day, like, that's work. And it takes time to really sit down and realize, okay, that's work, but what are the things that are really going to fulfill me and fulfill my passion and the things that I really want to do that can make, like, a little impact? And that's how I started getting involved in, like, a community garden. And now I'm on the board for a composting program. But prior to that, I mean, I couldn't even think about being on the board. I would just think about, like, I just want to go to your fundraiser and grab a drink. And that's support, right? That's like, you know, I gave them money for those tickets and the drinks, and that's still mutual aid in some way, because I mean, I was able to go to an event. I got to meet some people, got to talk, got to commune and learn about the different types of other programs they were planning to do, and they got some of my donations.
Well, and even presence is really important.
Yeah. Get outside, please, for your mental health, if not anything else. but also, like, another community garden that I got involved with, I mean, I don't know if I have capacity to do all the planting and seeding and all those kind of other things, but, you know, showing up to, like, help them plan events has been really cool, even if I don't have, like, that much event expertise. And I don't have to be the event coordinator, right? Like, those are other things that I really had to come to terms with and rectify in my brain. Like, oh my God, if I'm going to help, I need to do it perfect. And no, it's not. We need to move away from the idea of, like, I think what's already been ingrained in us, that we have to do everything ourselves if things are going to get done right, but that's not the point of community. It's not to do yourself. So, exactly. So yeah, those are some of my main takeaways.
Yeah. So if you want to stroke your own ego, start a charity. Looking at you, Mr. Beast. In that sense, sorry, I just had to do a little bit of Mr. Beast slander.
I did want to add one more thing before we moved on into, like, main lessons or takeaways. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe less of, like, a main lesson that I've had and more of just, like, a key reminder, wherever you are, make sure that you're uplifting minority voices. And minority voices can be, you know, what classification of minority, but a lot of times minority voices are the ones that are most affected by decisions that are made in these types of communities. And I've unfortunately seen sometimes in different groups that they are often kind of shushed, hushed, and put down while decisions that directly impacted them were being made. So just a reminder, and if you have to write it on a sticky note every day before you go out to do your little mutual aid or your volunteering, just make sure you're taking all of that into consideration in these efforts, I guess.
Yeah, it's almost a little ironic too, because it's the same people that really want, and I don't want to say like claim to want, because I do think that most people do generally want to help underrepresented minorities have a better position and be treated better, but in doing so they end up being patronizing and talking over, just completely like ignoring in some cases. So that kind of goes a little bit back into that charity mindset of like, I think I'm the chosen one to do this stuff. Like that to me, it's quite simple. It's just think about, you know, this kind of goes way back to what you were saying about introspection, and think about, why am I showing up here? Mm-hmm. What is my purpose for doing so? And in doing this, am I actually like living out those values, or am I just doing something to make myself feel better, which is probably not like the worst thing in the world. We all want to feel good about what we do, right?
Yeah, of course. It's not, yeah, it shouldn't be. I mean, we're talking about just like introspection in the right way, right? Like, do what makes you feel good, but like for the right reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I don't want you to have to like dwell on any mistakes or anything, but if you had to like sum up your experience organizing, is there any advice that you would give, or if you do have any like mistakes that you made that it's just like, oh, if someone would have told me sooner, I would have done this a different way. What can you sort of share with us when it comes to that?
That's a good one. That's a really good one. I mean, I think one of the reasons why I brought up Uplift Minority Voices goes into probably, and I don't think this is like a huge mistake on my part that I made, but was something that I definitely had to reflect on, like, whoa, what just happened in that room and why. It's funny now I say that like I'm involved in like community gardens and I'm involved in like these composting programs, but a couple years ago I was at like a abolition training for an organization that I wanted to get involved with locally. And part of the training was like trying to put things into practice, and we broke out into groups to talk about like different projects that we wanted to work on. And I remember very specifically, I was like, oh my God, you know, it would be amazing if we could just like, there's so many underutilized lots in Brooklyn, and like, it would be great if we could just build a bunch of community gardens. Like, there's already a lot in Brooklyn, but in certain neighborhoods, they're not really kept up with. There's not a lot of volunteers. There's not a lot of like infrastructure there. And so I remember bringing this up, and people were really excited about this idea. And a black man from Brooklyn, you know, he was like, yeah, that sounds great. But if we do this, like, we need to make sure we're thinking about this in a way to like make it accessible. Like, it shouldn't feel like a gated community trying to go and get some fucking plants and fruit from the community garden. And I was thinking like, okay, yeah, I mean, how, like, thinking about like, okay, how do we set that up in a way that like would make sense? Like, what does that look like, right? But obviously was in a group with more than five people, so it wasn't just me and this one person. It was an open conversation, and I remember just like other people chiming in and being like, well, we do have to keep it safe, and we do have to make sure that like we're protecting it from vandalism and other things in a way that like was not how I at all intended that conversation to go. And I remember just feeling so disillusioned and disheartened. Just like, I just like couldn't even understand what was happening. Because part of the conversation was to talk about like combating gentrification in my area with a lot of people that just outright were not from my area. So I just like shut down and didn't talk and didn't speak up. But, you know, going back to like uplifting those voices is part of that reflection that I've had to have on my own, because even though I myself am a minority, I still navigate this world differently than other types of minorities do in this country. And I have to really be cognizant of that so that way I can do the important work and push it forward. So that's one thing, right? Like that comment isn't because of just like, you should do this. Like, I've had to come to terms with that. Like, how do I make sure I'm incorporating these things? Aside from that, you know, starting small is another thing. I in the past wasn't always sure like how I would plug in and how to make a difference. And I thought of like change being this, in a similar to the way people think about the revolution, it's this one big thing and everything's gonna just one day to the next, it's just going to be day and night, right? But that's not necessarily how it works. And I think because of that, it was hard for me to figure out where and how to plug myself into. Mm-hmm. Like, I would go to protests, and a lot of times, like, I wouldn't know how to follow up and follow through with some of those things, and how to, like, make sure that what I'm doing is not only making a statement, but it's actionable. Like, I can follow up and do something afterwards that will work towards making a difference. So those are just two things I have. I can go on and on and on, but the two main things would be making sure you're including the voices that need to be heard, that will be directly affected in whatever you're trying to work on, and, you know, really honing in your focus so that way you don't do too much or overwork yourself or even just burn yourself out to not even wanting to do anything at all.
Yeah. Well, and I guess if I could only add one thing to that, it's actually something that you said in the previous episode about getting used to just being uncomfortable and, like, having to really sit with things not always going the right way. And I think that we always want these things to be perfect. We want to, like, go out there and help, and then everybody's day is going to be better. Like, we solved world hunger. Like, we're done, guys. But something that I try to keep in mind whenever I'm doing this stuff personally is, like, we're going to make mistakes. We're not going to be able to serve everybody's needs. We can try our very best, but there's always going to be, like, something that we missed, something we could have done better. And I like to think about that sort of growth mindset, maybe to use, like, a buzzword that people would be familiar with. That having that growth mindset of we can do better and better each day. And as we get more people involved in mutual aid, as we get more people involved in these organizations, we can make them better because of everybody's contributions. And that just is better for everybody involved. So I try to keep that kind of stuff in mind. But then there's also more practical things too, like your safety during organizing. You want to make sure that you're being secure, you're being safe. Even if you go on to do some protesting stuff, like, you're going to want to know how to protect yourself there. And I think that stuff kind of falls a little bit outside of, like, what we're talking about here today. But just in general, was there anything that you can think of off the top of your head related to just general, like, how to keep the peace, how to be safe doing all of this, that if you had to give advice on, that you would?
I don't think my advice would be any different than the advice I've already given. I mean, community is how we keep each other safe, right?
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to certain things, especially in this current climate, something like protesting can be turned into something really dangerous really quick. But, like, to make sure you're not doing those things alone, making sure you're thinking about what happens, right? You go through scenario planning, like, okay, if somebody gets arrested, what's the plan? If cops do come, what's the plan? If this happens, what's the plan? And yeah, for protesting, I guess that would be my main advice. And then also thinking about, again, these things are not things that have just, like, we're doing something completely different for the first time ever. These are things that have happened before. There's yeah. a model there for us to look back on. So, like, just to look back at some of those models, whether it's other local orgs that have done the same thing, or whether it's we're looking at other orgs in different cities, like, what was their approach in order to know what is best practice.
Yeah. Cool. So before we start doing our little outro and stuff, is there anything else that you think we didn't cover, or just something that you're dying to get off your chest before we wrap this up?
Dying to get off of my chest? I guess I just want to tie back our conversation kind of to, like, how our conversation started when it came to, like, the finger pointing and feeling, I guess, a little bit disconnected with the work and with just overall what's going to be happening in our political climate during or after Trump's inauguration. You know, one goal for organizing or one goal for campaigning or for doing different things in your community oftentimes is turning confusion into understanding. That is something that we are taught as organizers in a lot of different spaces, but the goal is to turn confusion into understanding, right? It's easy to look at other people and be like, well, they're fucking stupid. And that could be true, but also we should be bridging that disconnect if we really do want to see change in this world. And I think this goes back to the advice that I received from someone a few weeks ago that I met at a screening about gentrification in Puerto Rico. And I was having a conversation with them afterwards. Like, I'm just so frustrated with these groups because some of these groups don't really care, right? They don't really care about what's going on, you know? Like, going back to the abolition group for a little while, I felt like they don't really care. If they cared, then they would have understood XYZ and why XYZ was not okay. But this person, like, really encouraged me to be like, well, no, Yasmin, as an abolitionist, you have to care. You have to care. And if they don't care, you need to be the one bridging that gap. And, you know, there's this whole trope of like, okay, well, like who does the labor really fall on top of? And like, that's a whole nother conversation that we can have. But in general, really, if we want to see change, we have to turn confusion into understanding. So I just wanted to tie that back there, that for everyone listening, you know, it feels like a lot, and maybe it will be a lot of work, but it's not hopeless. It's not going to be hopeless. It may feel hopeless. It may feel very doomsday, which is why my main advice is, you know, protecting your peace, avoiding burnout, and just, you know, taking care of yourself before you feel like you need to take care of others, because we just need to fill our cup before we can pour out of it, you know?
Yeah, word. Okay, well, I think that about wraps up everything. I will be leaving some links for some resources, especially when it comes to legal aid. And before we go, though, I will just say probably the easiest way that you can get involved is to simply do a Google search for any organizations that are local to you. Because, again, remember, this is going to come down to what's closest to you and what you can most easily and tangibly affect. So I know personally, like where I live, I was able to search on Google where I live plus mutual aid, and it popped up with the network in my area. There was already people activated and involved, and they had links to join and Venmos and PayPals to send money towards for donations. So this stuff is out there, we promise. You just gotta kind of do a little bit of digging to find it, but I'm gonna try my best to make that a little bit easier for you. So I'll leave some links in the description of wherever you're listening to this or watching this. And as well as just some general resources about mental health and all of the other stuff that we had talked about here today. So other than that, I think that's it for episode 2, and we'll see you all in the next one.
Bye.